Okay, I've got the recording on, and God, it's been so long since I've seen you guys all 1 hour ago. Actually, it was about 2 hours ago now, huh? Because we ended at 12:30. Okay, I hope everybody got lunch and got a chance to go outside a little bit. It is a beautiful day outside, and I am here in my cave. And I figured out finally that by not turning the lights on in my office, that it doesn't get swelteringly hot in here. So I've got all of these halogen lights that are up above me. It gets super hot. So I've moved to an LED light now that does not get so hot. And the problem is if I open the window and take the screen out of the window that I've got in there, then we get blinded by light on one side and you can't see anything that I'm actually sitting here and presenting. So, so I spend Monday and Wednesday in the cave in the dark, and it's working out now. Okay, we're doing spectroscopy today, and what we did for lab last time is we presented how to do spectroscopy. We presented how to interpret spectroscopy. Today is supposed to be actual practice of interpreting spectroscopy, so that's what we're doing today. And I alluded to the fact in lecture that this morning's lab did not go well. I was going to spend some time this afternoon in the 2 hours that I had in between lecture and now to get some more examples to actually do a better job today, but I got crushed in office hours, and so I'm left with the same examples that I had last time, but maybe I can do a slightly better job with it. I think I can get them back and forth to my iPad a little faster than what I was doing before. And the problem is that there's so much that I want to write that I don't want to just have the spectra preloaded into my iPad because there's no way to move them around once they get embedded in this application. They're kind of stuck and fused wherever you drop them. So this is where we're at. So I have a spectrum that's up on the screen, and I have some annotations on that spectrum. The annotations you need to be careful with. Let me explain annotations for a second. When you annotate a spectrum, what you do is as the chemist, as the lab technician, when you take the spectrum, you go in and you analyze all the different peaks and you decide to mark the peaks by intuition. You're not marking them to say that these are the important peaks necessarily. That's what you hope that you're doing, but not all the time is that the way it works out. So when you do peak picking, there's generally two ways to do peak picking. One way is to take and set a threshold line and say, all right, everything that is below this line will get a number on it. So these peaks here would all get numbers on them. That's one way to assign peaks. And that way works, except if there's a lot of peaks, then they all get picked. And there's no way to tell what's important and what's not important. And so what people typically do is they set the threshold line way up high. And then once the threshold line is set, then they also have a size determination that says that any peaks greater than a certain threshold will also be picked. And that allows you to go through and pick everything that is of a longer peak. And some of these things might get picked and some of these things might not get picked because they were too short. So that's another way to do peak picking. Neither of those ways picks the important peaks, the peaks that actually tell you something. So if you want to pick the peaks that actually tell you something, then you need to actually understand what it is that you're looking at and which peaks are important. And the problem is that most of the time when we're acquiring the spectrum, we don't know that. We only know which peaks are important after we analyze a spectrum, not at the time that it's being acquired. So when you go and you look at a spectrum, there may be many, many peaks that have numbers on them that are annotated, and some of them you want to pay attention to, and some of them you don't. And it is up to you in analyzing the spectrum to decide which peaks are important and which peaks are not important. So for instance, in the spectrum that we're looking at right now, the peak that is here in this area, these four peaks, are all carbon-hydrogen stretches and are not really important in deciding what compound is giving rise to this spectrum. So if those peaks aren't important, then the question is, well, what other peaks become important here, and what is it that I need to look at? And that comes from experience and from practice. And so what we're looking at now is, usually we don't start from just a blank spectrum and try to figure out what compound it is. When we're starting off, it's much more practical to have a list of compounds and to think about the properties that each compound will have that would be represented in the spectrum, and then look to see if it is in the spectrum. For instance, what we can do is we can take each one of these compounds and we can decide what the main points of the compound would be. For instance, the alcohol. The alcohol should have a broad swoop with then some carbon hydrogens and then a whole bunch of fingerprint stuff down at the end. But the alcohol is defined by having that broad, strong peak that is out in the 3400 to 3200 range. And so that's what I would be looking for. The carboxylic acid oftentimes has a jaggedness in that area. It will also have a carbonyl at 1700. That is a terrible carbonyl. Oh no, I don't want to erase the whole thing. It's gone. Too late. One more time. Start over. So we have the jagged swoopy thing. And then we get out here and we get the sharp carbonyl peak and then a bunch of other things. And so we get in the 3400 to 3200. And then this is around 1700 in reciprocal centimeters. Those would be what those two compounds would look like. If I take and look at some of these others, I would need to know what an ester looks like, but this ester would have just the carbon hydrogen stretches, and then it should have a 1700 peak, and then oftentimes it gets some other peaks that are in here too. Oftentimes it has a pretty strong peak, like around 1100. So the 1100 peak is the carbon-oxygen single bond, whereas the 1700 is the carbon-oxygen double bond. The ketone would have some carbon-hydrogen stretches and then a sharp peak and a bunch of fingerprint stuff. This would be around 1700. And the aldehyde, likewise, is going to have some carbon-hydrogen stretches and then a 1700 and then a bunch of fingerprint stuff. So what makes it difficult to distinguish is trying to distinguish the aldehyde from the ketone when they both have very similar sorts of wavelengths, wave numbers that they show up at. So let's go back to our spectrum now that we've kind of done this little bit of analysis, and which compounds can we throw out and say that those compounds definitely do not match the spectrum. So I'll shrink it down even a little bit more. We've got A, B, C, D, and E, and the patterns that we would expect to see. Are there any compounds here that I can throw out? The alcohol. Yes, I can throw out the alcohol. Exactly. So E is crossed off. E is not represented in the spectrum. If it was, I would get the strong alcohol peak that would look like that. So that would be the alcohol peak, and that is clearly not in my spectrum. Oops, that is not. Okay. What else can I throw out of this? I threw out the alcohol. Can I throw out any other compounds that definitely are not represented in the spectrum? Nobody's coming up with anything. I'm waiting to see D. Why D? Come on, Shelby. Unmute that microphone. Tell me why D.
The big fluffy curve.
The big fluffy curve. Okay, so.
Isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the shaggy beard thing. That's what we would be seeing in terms of D. So what I would see in terms of D, if that were there, is I would typically have something that would look more like this, along with the 1700. That's what a carboxylic acid would look like. That would be coming from the hydroxyl component of the carboxylic acid. And that is definitely not in the spectrum. So D is out as well. Good. Okay, what else can I maybe throw out, given the other hints that I've looked at here or that we've drawn? E is out, D is out. What about B? I'm seeing an 1130, but the way that I drew in Esther was to have a peak that is one of the major peaks, that the peak here that is the carbon-oxygen single bond would be a strong peak if there were an ester functional group being present there. And so from that being strong and not there, I can also throw out B, throw out the ester component. So it's not B, it's not D, it's not E, and we need to decide between A and C, that this compound is either a ketone, could be a ketone, Eric, or could be an aldehyde. And I need to decide whether it's a ketone or an aldehyde. So I need more information in order to be able to assess whether it's a ketone or an aldehyde. So what I'll do is I'll go grab a table. Let's grab this one. And we'll stick this into our note. And in grabbing this table, what we can do is we can use the color coordinations and say, all right, aldehydes are here at 1725. And ketones are here at 1715. And we'll go back up and we'll look at our number. Our number is here, 1750. So 1750 is sitting up at this range right here. This is 1750 reciprocal centimeters. And 1750 is not an aldehyde or a ketone. 1750 is coming up by the anhydrides. So what is the 1750? Well, when we take a look at these things, what we're not maybe understanding is that when we look at an aldehyde and we look at a ketone, that the aldehyde as a functional group shows up at 1725, but that's the center of the peak, and that aldehyde can range plus or minus 30 units depending upon what else is attached to the aldehyde, whether it's conjugated or whether it has sterics next to it or other things that can affect it. So that means that if I do plus or minus, that was not what I meant to do. I didn't really want to move that around. I want that right there. If I considered this to be plus or minus 30 reciprocal centimeters, and sometimes I think this is a little bit too conservative, but we can imagine now that this can go up to like 1750 and down to 1690. And that's the range of what I see an aldehyde can show up at. And that range is actually a little bit bigger than that. And ketones, when I look at a ketone, the range for the ketone is coming out and centered on 1715. But this likewise has a range of plus or minus 30. So I've got to make a box here for this one as well. And this box is plus or minus 30. This is the problem that I have with most tables, is that most tables don't adequately, so this can go up to like 1745 and down to what, 1685, down that direction. Okay, and there's a lot of overlap between these two. Go for it, Galen. No worries. Galen, you still in here? Galen ducked out. Galen can watch the video later on. It'll be cool. Okay. So because these two are overlapping, We need to make a decision as to which of these structures it is. And it might be hard to make that decision. But what we can say is that because this is up at 1750, that it's more likely that this is an aldehyde that is up at 1750 than it is a ketone that is up at 1750. That if the number were much closer to 1725, we'd have a harder time ascertaining which one it actually is because of the amount of overlap between these two. So we could say that anything in here, we wouldn't know whether it was an aldehyde or a ketone. But because we're up at 1750, which is the upper end for the aldehyde, that this is a good bet that this is actually an aldehyde. And that's how we would do that decision-making process. And so we would go back up to the spectrum and we would say 1750, that this is most likely the aldehyde and that that is the answer that we are going to choose and that that is the correct structure. So that's... And notice that I did not use anything other than that one peak because they're giving me the compounds that could be the possible compounds. And there may be other things in the compound, other structures within the compound that I could point to and look for within the spectrum. But here, all I need to do is really ascertain, based on the functional groups that they're giving me, which spectrum seems to be the closest fit. And for this one, it would be the aldehyde. And so what I do then is I take and annotate the spectrum. So I'm going to bring the spectrum in one more time. And it should drop it into a new page for me. Let's see if it does or not. Still downloading. Come on. There we go. We'll add to this lecture. We'll import. Should dump it down in a new page, which it did. And I need to get to the bottom of that page. So I'm going to add a page to it. And I wished it had dumped it kind of at the top rather than at the bottom. That's okay. Okay, so this compound, what I tend to do with spectrum is to then annotate the spectrum. This is butanal. And butanal has the peak that is the carbonyl peak, the carbon-hydrogen stretch, which is this guy here, which is showing up at 1750. And these here are carbon-hydrogen stretches. And everything that is out here is considered to be fingerprint. Which means that it comes from functional groups, but it doesn't tell me specifically what functional groups are present in my molecule because there's just too many things that overlap down in that area. And then we've got these two little guys right here. And those two little guys right there could be what's called enol character. So let me show you what enol character means. When you have water and you have two water molecules, one of those water molecules can act as an acid and the other one can act as a base, and you can get hydronium plus hydroxide. And this is the auto ionization of water. And it has a Kw, which is equal to 1 times 10 to the minus 14th. You guys are really, I mean, that was all of Chem 1B in a nutshell, right? Not all of it, but I mean, there was a lot that you did with acids and bases and the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation and calculating out pHs. And all of that, you used Kw consistently and frequently, which was the auto-ionization of water. And what that means is that one of these water molecules is acting as an acid and the other one is acting as a base. Now, why would one water molecule act as an acid and the other one act as a base? They're both water molecules, they're both neutral. And why are they acting differently? Why doesn't water just always act the same? Why does it always do this no matter what? If I take all the ions and I deionize water, water still has ions present in it. It has hydronium and it has hydroxide. And yeah, because it's amphoteric, meaning that water can act as an acid or a base. The answer is because it can. That's why it tends to react that way, is water just can. It's amphoteric. It can either be an acid or a base, and it chooses to act both ways, and it auto-ionizes. Aldehydes and ketones do the same thing. They have an auto-ionization of a sort. One of them acts sort of like an acid, the other as a base. And what they do is they have an equilibrium, which is favored towards the aldehyde. So I want to favor it this way. But a small component of it forms what's called an enol. So this is the enol. And it's a form of tautomerism. This is the aldehyde. And this is called tautomerism. Tautomerism is a relationship in the location of a proton. So this is a relationship in the location of a proton. So the proton that we're talking about that is existing in a different location is that if I take one of the protons that is here, it is that proton there that is showing up in that location over there. The other proton that is here on that carbon is still on that carbon, still located in its same spot. But one proton is changing its location, and this is a form of tautomerism. And even if you dry this to the best of your ability, you cannot prevent the tautomerization, and a little bit of it shows up in the spectrum there. And that's what those little peaks are that are there. So a little bit of enol character that is showing up, which is not part of the rest of the molecule, but is present in the spectrum. Okay, so really diagnostically, all we needed to pay attention to was the 1750. How are you guys doing? Did going through that example make sense? And how I threw out each one of the compounds, thinking about what the compound shape would be and whether or not it was represented in my molecule or not. Looks like I'm getting thumbs up from most everybody. Cool. Okay, let's go on to the next molecule, and I'll import another one. And we'll start over again. So give me a second while I go grab another molecule. This is made tricky by the fact that I literally need a third monitor to manage everything. So I've got two monitors up plus an iPad, and I still can't manage all the information that I need to have. All right, takes a second. Let me clip this rectangular selection tool. And then we will share it with my iPad. We'll add it in, import. Okay, so we've got a new spectrum. This new spectrum looks like I need to add a page below it. Now I should be able to write. Okay. So this spectrum, annotation-wise, I know it's hard for you guys to see on your screen, so I'm going to blow up the annotations a little bit. This is 3050, 2946, 1710. I've got 1394, 1242. 1126, and 7:30. Okay, there's all my annotations. And then the compounds that this one could be. Let's start off with two compounds. So molecule A or molecule B. And we want to ask which one of these molecules fits this structure. This one is more challenging. This one doesn't have a whole bunch of different functional groups. What this one has is a difference of a location of a double bond. And so we need to sort of understand what the difference in the location of that double bond is really doing. So in this sense, what we've got is this molecule on the right, left, on the left is called cyclohex-2-ene, just one E, E-N, one one-one. And the other one is cyclohex-3-ene, one one-one. So the numbering system, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, and 3. The 3 denotes where the double bond starts. The 2 denotes where the double bond starts. The number 1 is where the ketone is located. So these two differ in the location of the ketone. And so what we have here is we have the carbon-hydrogen stretches. So that's what's there. We have a fingerprint region. And then we have the carbonyl. Oops, that's not what I needed. We have the carbonyl that sits here. And so that's this piece structurally. What we need to figure out is structurally, where would this show up? And how does it affect what the carbonyl is, where the carbonyl shows up? So that if we go and we grab a different tool. Let's do it this way. Let's grab this. We'll copy it. That might be big enough. Okay. So what this is this has a term in it. The term that it's using is conjugation. Conjugation moves the reciprocal centimeters to a smaller number. Ring strain moves to a larger wave number. And so conjugation, we need to sort of understand what conjugation means. And we've used conjugated in the lecture course before. We talked about conjugated a little bit. We didn't spend a whole lot of time with it. But let's talk about what conjugation actually means and what it looks like. To be a conjugated double bond, conjugation implies that all of the atoms are sp2 hybridized and that they continue in an uninterrupted sp2 manner. What that means is that there is p orbitals that make up the pi bonds on each one of these double bonds, and that the system acts as though it is one giant pi bond, and it acts like a giant p orbital. So this is a molecular orbital that is pi-like. And what that does is that it gives it a barrier for rotation such that the molecule can't rotate about the sigma bond. That in order for the molecule to rotate about the sigma bond, it would have to break this extended conjugation that is here. and that would cost the molecule in its stability. So literally what happens is that in a conjugated system like this, what we have is the high energy sort of state, an activation energy barrier, and then the low energy sort of state, which is a pseudo cis versus a pseudo trans sort of type of conformation. And it costs us energy of activation in order to rotate them. And that energy of activation is breaking the extended pi bond. This is what we mean by a conjugated system. So this system is conjugated. Extended pi system. A system that is not conjugated looks like this. So this system has sp2, 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 and sp2 out here, but this carbon is an sp3 carbon. So when I look at the molecular orbital for this system, what I see is that I get the classic pi bond where the double bond is, but that these are two different pi systems. And that they are not talking to each other. And that this sp3 hybridized carbon that is sitting here acts like a block. It blocks conjugation. And that changes the wavelength that I see for conjugated systems versus non-conjugated systems and how they interact with the infrared spectrophotometer, with the infrared light. So what we see is that conjugated systems, and conjugated doesn't have to be just with a double bond. For instance, conjugated can be that I have a conjugated aldehyde or a conjugated ketone, that they are all sp2 hybridized and linked together. And so these are examples, conjugated examples. So when we go back up to the molecule that we were looking at, one of these molecules is conjugated and one of these molecules is not. Which one of them is conjugated, A or B? You can throw it into the chat. You can unmute. You can do whatever you want to do there. So Eric's got one. Everybody agree with Eric that A is the conjugated one? So this system over here is conjugated. And B is isolated. It's the way that we would refer to those two. Okay, so based on the table that we had before, where's that table we had before? Here we go. Ketone should be at 1715. But if a ketone is at 1715, then as we come back down here, I guess I could have done it that way. There's normal, 1715. Conjugated will move to a smaller wave number, whereas ring strain would move to a higher number. So the isolated system, I would expect at 1715, thereabouts, approximately. And the conjugated system, I'm going to expect to be less than 1715. I'm going to expect it to be somewhere in, I don't know, the early 1700s. Let's see what we've got. So we've got 1710. So 1710 might seem to make it a little bit hard to call, but 1710 is less than 1715. Why can I not write all of a sudden? So this is less than 1715. And that would sort of imply conjugated. That would imply that the correct answer would be A for this system. We could also look at that and ask, well, where does that double bond show up? But they both have double bonds. So we'll save that for the annotation section. But that's how I would make a decision between these two compounds, is conjugated versus unconjugated. It affects the wavelength of the carbonyl spectrum that I would be looking at. And so I would make my choice appropriately there. Let's bring this in. Let's bring it in one more time. And I'll fully annotate it out. And we'll get a new page. Add in a page below it. That'll make it a little bit easier to annotate on it. Okay, so the compound that we have here is the cyclohex-2-ene-1-one. This is conjugated. It's a conjugated ketone. And the carbonyl is showing up at 1710. So this is the carbonyl component. And the double bond shows up in a couple of different places. The double bond shows up here at around close to 3000. This is a CH stretch for a carbon-carbon double bond CH stretch. Whereas these that are down here, these are carbon-hydrogen stretches, which are sp3 hybridized carbon stretches. The other place that it shows up is it shows up at approximately 700. This one's showing up at 730. And down here, this is the carbon-carbon hydrogen bend, I think it is. I need to look and see which one it actually is. And there's one more spot where it shows up too, but these are hard to find. And so I don't rely on these. This is hard to see because they're so small. And the other one bends down into the fingerprint range. And so I don't tend to look for those. Really, the deciding factor was the fact that this was a conjugated ketone, and that it moved this spectrum from the 17, I could do it this way, moved this spectrum from what was 1715, that would have been a normal ketone, down to 710. And that's how I made my decision-making process in that spectrum. That one was a bit harder to work out. So let me stop for a second and ask if you guys have any questions. The chart below showed the conjugated system shifting down to 675. Let me go to the chart. Not to 1675. It depends upon what type of molecule it really is. Let's take that chart. Let me get that chart one more time and explain kind of what's going on in that chart and why this was probably not the best choice on my part for molecules. But let me go back to here, grab this chart one more time, copy it, bring it back in, and expand it out a bit. Okay. If we think about this as a conjugated alpha beta unsaturated ketone, then what we're doing is we're going from the 1715 on down to the 1675. And so the answer is yes, Eric, 1675 is about what I would expect. However, what also happens here is that in this normal range, ring strain takes me this direction. And if I think about the molecule that I'm dealing with, that even though it doesn't look like there's ring strain within this molecule, the fact that there is a double bond in the six-membered ring system means that it can't go in a full chair conformation. And the chair conformation is what relieves a lot of ring strain. What happens is because of that double bond, the chair conformation looks a little bit more like this. We get sort of a twisted boat type conformation that comes out of it with the carbonyl fitted into this, and that this whole side of the system here is sort of flat, which equals some strain. And that strain takes what would have been from 1675 that I would have expected if it wasn't in a ring, and takes it into a linear format and introduces more strain and brings me back somewhat. So that's why it didn't shift entirely all the way down to 1675. It shifted, but it's also being drawn the other direction. So Eric, that's a great question. And a little bit about how you have to be careful with tables. I mean, more than anything, I think today's lesson is be careful with how you interpret tables and use tables, because sometimes the table is not an absolute number. The table is still a range that has a plus or minus in it. And there may be other factors that are both drawing it one direction and factors that are drawing it at the other direction simultaneously. And I love that question. That's a great question, Eric. Thank you for that. Anybody else have anything that they want to contribute or ask while we're here? No, you guys doing all right? Okay, let me see if I can grab another molecule. And this is where I started to have a bit of trouble this morning, and I had to ask somebody to find some elevator music and put some elevator music on for us. I downloaded, it's almost 20 spectra last night, and I was up until about almost 1 o'clock in the morning downloading spectra and getting these all ready. And what I found this morning is that more than half, I would say three quarters of the spectrum that I downloaded last night, while they demonstrated on the screen exactly what I wanted, when I downloaded the file, they gave me a snippet of the file. And it's a glitch that is in the NIH website that I was utilizing that I didn't realize actually existed. And so a large majority of the molecules that I wanted to show you, specifically a lot of the carboxylic acids and some of the other functional groups and alcohols and things, did not present the way that I expected them to. And I had two options. I could either download the file and put annotations into it so that I could give you the exact precise wavelengths, or I could download the files in a rough format without annotations, and then I just have to make up the annotations. And I've got no wavelengths. And so I thought I was doing the right thing by downloading the higher quality spectrum and working them up myself, until I found that there was glitches in their database and that half of these damn things weren't actually working. So that's where my hair started to be pulled out this morning, was because I thought I had all these spectrum that I could work from, and I kept pulling them up, and they weren't what I wanted them to be. And the hard part is that there are very, very few spectral databases where there are annotations with good quality spectrum that are adequate for teaching. There's a lot of shitty spectrum out there, which I hate to say, and it's hard to find good quality ones in these free databases. Okay, that's enough about my soapbox and my complaining. Let me stop complaining and do some teaching. Let me find another spectrum to work from. Which means I got to get Zoom out of my way for a minute, and I need to do a little bit of work. Okay, let me go find a spectrum for us, and it's going to be unannotated, but that's okay. We're going to do fine with it. Let's... let's do this. That is just not what I want. That looks a little better. Okay, let me grab this one. And it won't be annotated, but it'll be close enough for what we need. So here's a new spectrum, and let me ask, just by looking at the spectrum, do you have any sense of what type of compound this might be? What functional group might be present in this compound? Just by looking at the general shape that I've got here. So there's no annotations on it.
My guess would be a carboxylic acid.
Yeah, Eric, good. Good guess. So what I was going to do was give a couple of different possibilities. So we could have A, that this compound could be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This compound could be an alcohol. We could do a 5-carbon aldehyde. We could do C, we could throw in there 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This could be the carboxylic acid, or D, I could have 2, 3, 4, 5. This would be a ketone, or we could even put one more in here, E, 2, 3, 4, 5, a symmetric ketone. Okay, so each one of these compounds would present differently. So the alcohol, if I was thinking about the alcohol would have the smooth piece, nothing much, and then the fingerprint region. That would be the alcohol. The aldehyde would have the carbon-hydrogen stretches, and then would wait until I got the 1700 peak, around 17, we'll just say around 1700. The ketones, likewise, would only present out around 1700 and then have the fingerprint range. So that's what I'd be looking there. The carboxylic acid, that's the one that's going to have the shape to it, and it's also going to have the 1700 peak. And so I get both the 1700 and I get the hairy beard component. The centered ketone, likewise, is just going to have the 1700 in the fingerprint region and not a whole lot else going on. So out of this, what we can do is we can strike the hydroxyl group. We can strike everything that is just ketone-ish. And the only one that matches the spectrum is the carboxylic acid. So if I take and I bring this in again, just to be able to annotate it, let me grab that spectrum one more time and airdrop it. So this spectrum, while it doesn't have the annotations on it that I would like, we can go in and we can say, all right, this is 2, 3, 4, 5. This was pentanoic acid. And that the region that is here is the, try not to draw on the spectrum itself, the region that is here is the hydroxyl group from the carboxylic acid. These guys here are the carbon-hydrogen stretches that are coming through. And the peak that is over here that is at, looks like it's right close to 1600. That might be 1650 because it's pretty smack dab in the middle. So let's label it as 1650. That's the carbonyl peak that is showing up at that position. So that there, if we look at this guy and say, this is the carbonyl that is showing up here. And then we have the hydroxyl group that shows up, that is this whole big thing here. And actually, it's a little bit more than that. It's actually the whole broadness that carries it out all the way over into this part of the spectrum too is still part of that hydroxyl group. It's just that the carbon-hydrogen stretches are kind of overlapping underneath that. And then out in this range, we have the fingerprint region. So that's not a bad one. Even with the annotations, we can still tell that is a carboxylic acid. Matt, you said carboxyl because I'm saying the carboxyl group or a carbonyl group. Usually we refer to it either as a carboxyl group or a carbonyl group. Same term when we're talking about a carbonyl with different groups on it. I tend to just say carbonyl, but carboxyl. Carboxyl refers to this functional group. So this is sort of the carboxyl group where it's got the oxygen that's in there too, which can refer to either an ester or a carboxylic acid. That's what we mean by carboxyl group more so is the two oxygens connected to the carbon versus a carbonyl, which is just the one. And so, yes, the carbonyl is there from just the carbon-oxygen double bond. That's the carbon-oxygen double bond stretch. That's what we're showing in red. What we're showing in blue is the hydroxyl group from the carboxyl that is showing the hydrogen bonding and the hairy beard sort of component that's in that. Okay? Yeah, cool. All right. Let me go grab another molecule and see what I can find. So I'm working in the NIST Chemistry Webbook Archive, which is a very large free database. And it has better spectrum than the AISD website that I showed you the other day, the Japanese website. The Japanese website is great because the spectrum are annotated. And they're pretty good. The problem with them is that it's hard to screen grab them and turn them into something. And I thought that this one actually had the raw data, and that allowed me to work up the raw data on my own computer and to annotate it. And that's what I was trying to do, and I outsmarted myself. I figured that I was pulling down good data, and I started pulling down crap data. So between the websites, I'm trying to get you to see spectra and make decisions about what functional groups are present in that spectrum. And that means I don't want to just have a screen share while I'm showing me going to the website and pulling it up, because you would see the name and the structure, and that defeats the whole purpose. So let me try and pull up another one. Let's pull up this one. Let's see what we get. Should have IR. And one of these is going to be better than the other. This one is hard. No, I'm not liking that. That's not going to work for us. Okay. Let's see. We've done... Oh, I know what I want to do. Let me get... There it is. Let me see if I can annotate this spectrum, because this one would be a good one to show you annotated. So let me see if I can open it. So complicated. That's a good spectrum though. Okay. Now I got something. File print. Send it over to a PDF. Open it in preview. Clip it to get the name out of it. And send it to the iPad. The actual technology of how all these pieces connect together and the ability to move things over by Bluetooth is pretty crazy. Okay. Here we go. So this is a compound, and I'll blow up the annotations for us a little bit. So this is 2970. This is 1762. We've got 1446. I'll grab 1102. And we're out here at 1110. And this one was actually 1182. This was the 1102. Okay, so those are the annotations. That's the spectrum. What about functional groups? What do we think that we see in this? So anybody feel free to chime in while I try to find my app back up here. There we go, okay. Feel free to chime in and tell me what you think you see in the spectrum, excuse me. Remember that we're only analyzing two sections. So the sections that I'm asking you to analyze are the section that is here. And the other section that I'm asking you to look at is where hydroxyls and things show up, which is over here. And so the section that would normally have OHs and NHs, that section is looking pretty empty because right here, this is just the carbon-hydrogen stretch. So carbon-hydrogen stretch isn't really telling us much. And Matt, sharp dip at 1750, yeah, 1762, exactly. So the 1762 is telling me that this has what sort of functional group in it? Now, it doesn't have to be the exact functional group. I mean, we're looking at, is it a carbonyl or is it not a carbonyl? So at 1762, in around 1700, anywhere from, I would say, 1780, even up to 1800, all the way down to 16, maybe 30 or 40, can be a carbonyl. we need to define what type of carbonyl it is, but we know that this is a carbonyl. So if I were to give you a list of compounds and I were to say, A, could this thing be 5 carbons, 2, 3, 4, 5? Could this be an alcohol? Could this be 2, 3, 4, 5? Could this be a carboxylic acid? Could this be 2, 3, 4, 5? Could this be a primary amine? So that would be compound C. Yeah, it's a carbonyl, exactly. Not a carbondale. Yeah, autocorrect sucks. It gets me all the time too. So there's A, B, C, D. Let's look at 2, 3, 4. Maybe an ester and E. Let's make 2, 3, 4, 5. Let's make this a ketone. So that I've got not an alcohol because not a smooth, strong curve, right? So let's remind everybody, this is what I like to try to keep focus on, is that an alcohol would look like that big, smooth, sweeping curve. And we don't have that. So it can't be the alcohol. So the alcohol is definitely out. Carboxylic acid, if it were the carboxylic acid, it would have the jagged sort of curve that would look like that. And so that's what we would expect from the carboxylic acid. So the carboxylic acid is out. Can't be that. The amine would have two fairly strong peaks that would reside there in the OH-NH section. And we're not seeing that. So it can't be that guy. What it could be is it could be the ester, or it could be the ketone. And now we need a table and go to a table and decide on some more information. We need to acquire more information to decide which one of these it is. So let's go back to that table, grab this, and we'll bring it in. Okay, so between these, what we're looking at is we're looking at an ester, and esters show up here at 1735, or we're looking at the ketone, and the ketones show up here at 1715. So we come back to our pattern here, and we're at 1762. 1762 is all the way up here above the anhydrides. But if I just think about proximity-wise, it's more likely that this is the ester than it is that this is the ketone, right? So it's much more likely that the correct answer is the ester than it is the ketone, just based on the wavelength of the 1762. All right, there's one more thing in here that I really want to highlight, though, and that is that there are multiple functional groups within the ester, so that we have the carbonyl, which shows up someplace in the 1735, and that's plus or minus 30 wave numbers. There's also this bond, the bond that is here, that is the carbon-oxygen single bond. This bond tends to show up pretty close to 1200, maybe down to around 1100, and is a strong peak that shows up in that 1200 to 1100 range. So when we look at that, what I would say is that this bond here versus this guy here, that those two show up, the carbonyl showing up here, but the carbon-oxygen single bond being a fairly strong bond showing up at the 1182 bond, that's where the carbon-oxygen single bond is showing up. And the carbonyl showing up there. That those are the two strong peaks that are indicating that this compound is the ester compound. So whenever I think I have an ester, or when I have a carbonyl, I always look over and think, do I also have a carbon-oxygen single bond that this could be an ester? And that's one of the first things that I look for in that regard. So let me bring it over and bring in that compound one more time and just do a final sort of mock-up on it. We'll airdrop it in. It's amazing that I can move the files this way and yet still feels like it's slow. So that should drop it in. We'll draw the compound in here. 2, 2, 3, 4. This is methyl butanoate. That indicates that the OH is that this is an ester. And the functional groups that I am watching as I'm watching this carbon-oxygen single bond, which is showing up here at 1182. And I'm catching the carbonyl, which is showing up here, and that's at my 1762. I've also got my carbon-hydrogen stretches. And then this is just the rest of the fingerprint region. Okay, so one of the things that I would say is that IR spectroscopy is not generally meant to be a tool to rebuild structure. In other words, from an FTIR alone by itself, I can't tell what the absolute structure is. If I'm given a number of molecules that I can compare it to and make a choice, I can nail it down to one molecule. But between just getting a spectrum and trying to figure out what the molecule looks like from a spectrum, the only thing the IR is good for is telling you what functional groups are in the molecule and what functional groups are not. It cannot tell you the atom connectivity. It can't tell you how many carbons. It can't tell you the atomic structure overall. So there's nobody who looks at an IR, reads it, and tells you what the compound is unless they have seen that compound 100 times and it is imprinted in their brain and they know what the spectrum looks like. So IR spectroscopy in and of itself does not tell you what the atomic structure is. It takes other forms of spectroscopy together with IR in order to be able to figure out what the structure actually is. So it takes a combination of NMR, both proton and carbon, IR and mass spec in order to be able to figure out what the actual structure of a molecule is. And we can't do it from IR alone. You're never expected to read an IR and just tell what the compound is. The IR tells you functional groups only, and from other information, we can then pick out and figure out what the actual structure is. So hopefully you've got a little bit better of a feel of just looking at functional groups and figuring out from the specific two bands, and those two bands are the area that is here. Let's do it this way. Let's make a new spectrum that is just a general spectrum, and that we have the 4,000, we have down to about 650, and that the bands that are really important are this 3,200, 3,400 down to 3,200. We look at the 1780 on down to 1650. That's another band. And that these two bands are the most critically important bands. They tell you about the NH and the OH. They tell you about the presence of a carbonyl or not. And that these are the two areas where we spend most of our focus. And that there are other predictive bands that are in the IR range, but that these are of the most predictive power. And that these are the two areas that for now I would like you to focus on is these guys here. That should be easier to fill in. I need a bigger pen. So that's the wavelengths that I want to focus on. And as we get into lecture and we go into spectroscopy and lecture, we'll broaden that out a little bit. But we don't broaden it out a whole lot. and really we'll be using different types of spectroscopy together as we move forward in lecture and not just on IR. So don't get hung up in trying to interpret every peak. Try to keep focus that within these things, that at the edge of this peak, here there is generally the carbon-hydrogen stretches. There's another very characteristic peak that happens before the carbonyl that has to do with carbon dioxide that oftentimes shows up just from people exhaling while they're doing FTIR, and that the act of breathing, as you exhale CO2, the CO2 sometimes gets trapped in the crystal matrix that you're working with and shows up as a peak in the IR that is not part of the molecule itself. And so that can frequently show up from the carbonyls. That there are some things in the fingerprint region that can help, but most of the time we stay away from that part and we don't try to analyze that part. And then other than that, we go to the tables and we find a good FTIR table that helps us figure out what type of carbonyl we're using, and then another table that helps us to understand shifts, whether it's shifting ring strain, shifting to a higher wave number, or conjugation, shifting to a lower wave number. And that's the basics. That's what I need you guys to be able to do. Okay? So any sort of questions or any other questions? I think if I try to pull more examples up, you're going to spend more time watching me struggle to find adequate examples before I can get them into the iPad than we're going to spend actually analyzing them. And so I think at this point, I think I've shown you pretty much what I wanted to do and how to break down spectrums. And I've got several that are annotated in the notes, and those will be available to you guys. And other than that, I think that's all I pretty much want to do with this lecture. Unless you guys have questions that you want me to address. I'm sort of watching the chat at the same time that I'm watching the rest of it, and I'm not seeing any questions come up. Matt, oh, CO2 contamination. I was wondering if there are any other common mistakes in making the spectra. Yes, there are, and it's hard for me to describe. So maybe just drawing is probably the easiest way to show you. Most common mistake. Overloading the sample. Let's take a spectrum. Let me just bring this spectrum back in one more time, since I've still got it up. Or did I close it? Anything that's open. Let me bring this guy back in. Let's take a look at this spectrum. And if I overload it, and I put too much material into the sample container, then what winds up happening is the spectrum gets very saturated and goes all the way down to the bottom and starts to look like this. So if there's too much sample, remember the idea is that we said that we put one drop and made a thin film between the plates. So that if I have the two plates, I want that film to be very thin between the two plates. So I get a drop that fits within here. And that drop sits just inside there and gets spread out over the entire surface of that glass. If I add two drops or three drops instead of a single drop, And, or the other possibility is that sometimes within a plate, you can have a well within a plate. And the well can, it doesn't look like a well. Let me try this one more time. If I think about a divot that's been cut into the plate, and that as sample goes into that plate, it fills the divot. And as it fills the divot, it gives a longer path length for the light. It can make this saturated sort of pattern as well, because the path length and the light is being absorbed by too many molecules. And when there's too many molecules, you get too saturated a spectrum, and the spectrum becomes hard to read. You don't see the fine structure within the spectrum, because the spectrum both broadens, so it broadens out, and it also gets more intense. And both things happen such that it makes it really hard to read the spectrum. So keeping the solution dilute as possible is one of the keys to getting a good quality spectrum. The CO2 and breathing on things, having your face really close to the crystals while you're adding the solution, or when we're making solid KBR pellets, that's another place where you can breathe on it and you can get a heavy CO2 peak. And CO2 can come in and has a very distinct shape to it for the CO2 peak. And so breathing on it can insert a CO2 artificially. There are some other mistakes too that we'll talk about when we get to solid KBR pellets rather than liquids, but that's another day in another lab, and we don't need to do that today. But yeah, thanks for the question. That's a great question, Matt. Any other questions that you guys have?
Nope, thanks, Jason.
Cool, all right, let's call it then. And I'll get this one uploaded and get the notes up online, and we'll call it a day from here. Okay, thanks guys.